Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday, the 16th of July. Very nice to have you with us on this day, and we thank you for your participation. We welcome you to write to us and participate even more than you already are by simply listening. You can email us at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We have a great group of panelists assembled, and you can, you know, address your comments to them or just blow off some steam or whatever you need to do. We only ask that you keep it short, to the point, and send them to the right address, which is panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartak is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, our leader. I'm fine. I just want to say that I have to take my blood pressure because I've been watching the news this morning and listening to it. We just got through with the media project, and that's always testing. However, the idea that the governor of Georgia, I believe, is now telling his people, you know, really stupid things that they can't, his mayors and others, that they can't demand the wearing of masks, if I'm reading that right. It's just unbelievable what a hole Trump and his gang have gotten themselves into, and their numbers keep going down. And as a result, boy.
Yeah,
it's fascinating,
and it can affect the blood pressure because you do get very very upset about it. I mean, we all do. It's so upsetting to listen to. Yes, the Georgia governor is overriding all local mask orders in the state of Georgia, banning the cities and counties and localities from mandating masks. This is as obviously as the cases have spiked unbelievably. We also welcome to our panel discussion this morning Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. I thought it was going to be good morning, but after hearing that little bit of news, I think it's no longer good morning, at least if you live in Atlanta, for example.
Yeah. But it's troublesome all the way around because we've all seen shades of it, and it's you hope that people will get on board and say, all right, this is what we have to do to make a dent in this, instead of having day after day, months after it first appeared, of having a record number of cases. Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith joins us as well. Good morning, Jen. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I am well, but I am also equally dismayed at what's going on. And you can't see me, but I'm shaking my head that we just can't listen to scientists and doctors and experts.
I don't get it, but we'll talk about that some more, I promise. And Linda Ellerbe is here. Let me introduce her. She is a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist and just a groundbreaking journalist, one of the first women ever to anchor the national news with NBC, ABC. You even worked for CBS, too, didn't you?
I did. I tried to stay one step ahead of the posse.
and Linda, you always tell that wonderful story about, I believe it's you, who about how you thought it was you were writing a personal letter, but you put it on to the AP. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, I did. That's how I came to work in television, was making a large fool of myself in front of a large group of people, which, of course, once I got onto television, allowed me to do that in a really big way, to make a fool of myself in front of millions of people at a time instead of going door to door.
I don't think you made a fool of yourself. I love that story.
Thank you. On the subject of the governor of Georgia, I find it sad, humorous, but sad, that after putting this out, the governor's press spokesperson was very quick to point out that, oh, no, the governor himself recommended wearing masks.
Hmm.
At the same time, the governor put out an order saying no local community could force its people to wear masks,
yeah.
Which, you know, brings back to the subject of who's in charge here. The mixed messages that we are sending this country is outrageous and responsible for so many people dying and so many more people who are going to die. When we were producing Nick News, which was a news show about serious things for children, We had a sign on the set that said, "Who's in charge here?" And in that part of the show every week, we would feature some little something foolish that a grown-up had done, because we wanted kids to understand that sometimes people didn't grow wiser as they grew up. They just grew older. And we did it as a joke. It's now headline story, who's in charge here every day. And it's clear that no one is in charge here.
The
no one.
Headline in the Washington Post
How can you plan for a disaster you deny is real?
Well, right. And as the coronavirus crisis spins out of control, Trump issues directives, but still no clear plan. That's the headline in the Washington Post this morning.
Well, what he did to wait a second, he took an important move. He fired his campaign. Oh, boy. He fired his campaign manager and he brought in another schnook. So what will happen as a result of that, because the second guy is seen as more of a Republican sort of institutionalist as opposed to, somebody who, who just...
is a Trumpian.
Yeah, but he is a Trumpian, because otherwise he won't last. And, Linda, I wanted to get to one thing you mentioned about who's in charge, because in New York State we have it too. Andrew Cuomo has made on several occasions... assertion that he's in charge and not the various mayors, because there has to be a statewide policy. Very progressive, and he's right. On the other hand, the Georgia guy isn't right, making the same argument, because it leads to the kind of chaos and the kind of death that we've been talking about.
Yes, it does. I mean, this is, it is just... Fauci said this yesterday. It is time to stop this nonsense.
Right.
The fact that there are people who don't want this to be a crisis and cling to the idea that more cases won't mean more deaths are wrong. It is just that simple. The facts are there.
So what's Trump doing? Why is he doing this? Well, why is he doing it? That's the thing that makes everybody, Joe and me and everybody else he knew, scratch your head and say, okay, your numbers are going lower. You're behind Biden, who is no ball of fire, by double digit numbers. And yet you keep doing it. What is he thinking?
Well, I think I have an idea
word.
Namely, he goes by his gut.
Hold on. Go ahead. Vera, go ahead.
I think I know what he's doing. He goes by his gut. That means he decides what specifically is going to be done in the country, and he believes that he, in his management style, by telling, by willing scientists to come up with a vaccination program for the country in the next 3 months, he can just throw money at it. He can pressure all kinds of scientific communities. And like a miracle, we will all have the right combination of economic entrepreneurship, medical treatment, and will to turn things around. He just simply is anti-science himself. He doesn't understand. He has no intellectual curiosity to understand how this is put together, nor does he consider any country outside of the United States as worthwhile to look at in terms of what their public health policies are like and what's working and what we could actually introduce in the United States. So that kind of attitude of I am going with my gut, I am the person who decides and I know best, is what leads us into this.
I have a question for you. Very quickly, I have a question. As his gut gets bigger, so does his opinions?
Well, that's where his brain resides.
Where his brain resides.
Yeah, and it ain't in his guts. You got to go lower.
Yeah. And we're off. Go ahead, Jen.
I'm just going to say that it's not just a matter of who's in charge here. It's for the American people. It's a matter of who can we trust here? There is just no one to trust. And we're in multiple crises right now.
You don't trust Fauci?
There is, there is no place where, well, I think people do, but at the same time, we see, you know, the other people who are supposed, exactly, the people who are supposed to trust him and uplift him and his work, because we hired him to trust him to do the work, and then are constantly, you know, washing him over and saying no, and that's a problem.
Yeah, but we're voting with our polls, and we're saying no, Mr. President, you can't do this. We like this guy. His numbers keep going up, and yours keep going down. Now, at what point do you look in the mirror?
That's a question.
I don't think you don't. Yeah, I don't think I'm with you. I don't think that point ever comes for him.
Yeah, you know, the polls on Fauci, the latest poll that has, I believe, 64% of the American people say that they trust and follow his guidance, where 22 or whatever percent say that they don't. But those numbers are really good, especially in comparison, as Alan points out, to the president and how they believe he's doing in covering this issue, which I believe is in the 23-24%.
Well, you know what,
of
Joe,
the coverage of the issue.
You know what, that when you talk about 65% of the people trusting anybody in this country, that is a phenomenal number. I know that Governor Cuomo, who has that number in New York, is very pleased with that because he's never had it before.
Right. And so we look at this this idea of who's in charge and no clear plan. There is an immunologist at the University of California at Irvine, Ilhelm Masoudi, who likened the absence of a national plan to going on a road trip and not having a map, a circuitous and sickening journey that has left everyone from governors to school superintendents to local hospital leaders stuck in the mud and flailing around. Masoudi said, "It's a complete disaster. This is how this administration has handled this entire pandemic. Conflicting messages, knee-jerk reactions, lack of cohesive plans, and undermining the CDC and attacking science on a regular basis." I bring that up because also on Tuesday, and we didn't talk about it a whole lot yesterday, but you know, yesterday, or I was watching television, and there was an ad from the Trump campaign about Joe Biden and about how Joe Biden has cognitive issues and is forgetting things and doesn't make sense and all of this, and that was about 5 minutes before I started watching President Trump in the White House Rose Garden. It was 54 minutes of just a rambling stream of consciousness set of remarks, which I know we should be used to by now, but I still am not, with little or no mention of the coronavirus.
Yeah, we should not get used to that idea. You know, we should not just expect and accept that the president to ramble. And I will say the one thing that bothers me the most is cutting off the CDC from information, important public health information, that to me is a form of blatant censorship, and the results that will yield, it's completely criminal. It's denying people in our country from fair and accurate health care, because if the CDC doesn't have the information that needs from contact tracing and other forms of developing vaccines and all of this information together affecting different populations, they can't do what they're supposed to do, which is prevent disease.
You are so right. But what you're not right about it is that it's not criminal. I wish it were criminal. In my mind, it is criminal. It's killing tens of thousands of people because of this kind of approach to the pandemic. And yet, you can't put him in jail for it. And even when he leaves, you won't be able to put him in jail for it. It's just incredible.
And when you think, in addition to that, Alan, I think we need to consider the long-term consequences for this country and how the general population might look at scientific data. Perhaps increasing numbers will now say, well, you can't really trust any data coming from any of the national health institutes. They manipulate data. Why should we even accept vaccines? Have they been tested properly? I keep hearing questions related to, well, we're rushing through things now. The government is manipulating information. Perhaps they haven't tested on women or pregnant women or older populations. I will not get the vaccine even if it comes out. So the anti-vaccine movement might grow. People are deeply suspicious of long-term consequences or side effects. What this means for the United States for the coming decade is a renewed struggle to educate several coming generations about the use of data and medical information and how important it is to interpret for public health. I think this is going to be a crisis that we cannot overcome just by, you know, in an election or one sort of governmental cycle. This is going to shape public health for years to come, in my view.
Let's pause there. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. We always welcome them. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'd love to hear what you think on this topic and the many others we'll be discussing over the next hour and 15 minutes that we have left. panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jen Smith, and Linda Ellerbe make up the panel this morning. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. panel@wamc.org for you to get in on the discussion. We also, of course, welcome our wonderful panelists who are with us: Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jen Smith, and Linda Ellerbe. Let us go to some letters. The Barry writes, the governor of Georgia and Donald Trump are promoting racist policies using COVID to kill potential voters for Biden. John says something I've heard. I don't know if I heard it on your show or elsewhere, but Trump reportedly stopped funding for COVID, et cetera, when he heard it was mostly minorities in cities that were getting ill. That suggests genocide of Democrats. When you look at this that way, what the South and West are doing makes sense. Anyone on that?
I'm going to have to see more proof on that. I mean, it seems very easy to believe, but I have not. Maybe somebody else has complete evidence that this is a planned attack. I don't think so. I almost think that's giving him too much credit.
Yeah.
I think that this has come about for the reasons that we all know. His own belief in his own rightness, and you know his own idiocy. You talked about the speech in the Rose Garden. I would like to just read two paragraphs from that speech. This is the President of the United States, and this is verbatim. Well, you know that we have one of the lowest mortality rates anywhere. If, you know, Biden and Obama stopped their testing, they just stopped it. You probably know that. He's looking at the media at that point. I'm sure you don't want to report it. But they stopped testing right in the middle. They just want no more testing and on a much lesser problem than the one we have now with respect to. This is the worst thing that's happened since probably 1917. This is bad all over the world. It's 188 countries now. But now we test any more than anybody by far, and when you test, you create cases, so we've created cases. If this is the man in charge, don't tell me that he has planned some specific conspiracy to weed out Democrats in this. This is a man out of control. This is a child. This is a moron. I will try to stop sugarcoating my opinions any moment now.
Please don't.
I think Linda, though, is right in some ways that many Republican voters, Trump supporters, I suspect, will also be deeply affected by COVID outbreaks, get sick or even die, because they tend to be age-wise, often in the category that allows you to experience the symptoms more directly rather than younger people, and so I think it's a mix of things. I think I agree. It's sort of this not this targeted policy, although I do believe he cares less about the spread of COVID-19 in urban environment because it has predominantly affected, you know, people of color. I think that is true. That is true. He cares less about
that. Oh, I think he's delighted by the fact that it has. I just don't think that was his planning.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, no, and
as you say, the older population, many of whom tend to be Republican, you notice I say many of whom because I am in the older population. But they are at risk, too. They are at high risk, so you would have to say, well, how did he plan to exclude those from his war on people he doesn't like? And regarding your comment about the CDC and the undermining of science here, you couldn't be more right. In taking it out of the CDC and putting it into essentially political hands, putting the scientific information regarding this virus, both the collecting and the reporting of it, into political hands, my goodness, this is so 1984. This is, I suppose we're going to change Health and Human Services' name now to the Ministry of Really Good Health.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Please, no.
Alan? Go ahead, Jen.
Just to get back to the letter writers, fears is that this is also happening around the globe where we see these disproportionate effects. And so you can blame it on governments not liking people of, different classes or different races. But the virus is disproportionately impacting communities of racial and ethnic minorities around the globe.
Alan? And don't you think that that's a consequence of our systematic racism around the globe more
Absolutely.
Than it is a consequence 100%. Of a targeted thing right now?
Well, I don't think
racism is not exclusive to any geography on this planet.
I agree.
That's true. I don't think we have to beat this one to death because I think that the panel has correctly identified the fact that this is not, in his own warped mind, bad for him. And almost everything that he does and every decision he makes is this good for me or is this bad for me? I don't think we have to argue about whether it's purposeful or not. Because what happened, and I've said it too many times, he stood up there before the American people and he said, we have 5 potential cases, those will be wiped out, maybe 15, and then it'll be over. And now tens of thousands of people, and by the way, a lot of younger people are getting it now. A lot of people under the age of 30 or under the age of 40 are getting it now. And that's why his numbers are going down, because he is seen by the American people as totally incompetent when it comes to managing this crisis.
And yet the politics, if I can overstep here, I've talked way too much this morning.
Not at all.
The way politics has taken over even medicine and the way politics has taken over our own feelings of it. I have a friend who is a young journalist. She is young to me. She's almost 40, very young. And she's in Sacramento, and she's a very good young journalist. And she was sent out to ask people about why they wore masks or why they didn't on the street. And she's a television reporter. And she went out and she asked them. And she also just incidentally, after they responded on why they wore masks or why they didn't, she asked them, oh, by the way, who do you plan to vote for in November?
Yeah.
Would you be surprised if I tell you that right down the line, the people who were against masks plan to vote for Trump, and the people who said masks need to be worn were Democrats? And she put it on the air, and she did not point it out. She did not signpost it in any way. She quite rightly left something for the audience to do. But it was amazing to me that people weren't even hesitant to join their politics with their feelings about a disease.
There was a great story this week on the television. It wasn't great because it was so sad, of an older guy who was basically somebody who leaned right and who said, you know, I always said it was a hoax. And he said, and he was on death's door, and he died. And he said, right before he died, I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that.
Well, and that is the another one of these issues of how did we? I know you asked this a lot, Alan, of how we got here, of how did we get to this point where science didn't matter, and we were putting our political beliefs before that of our. You know, my story, we're all sort of telling stories about people that we know. But, you know, my personal story is that I have nieces and nephews, and there are people who are planning all of these travel sports leagues. And they want the parents want their kids to go to Delaware to play soccer and lacrosse. I don't get it. First of all, why can't you play it here safely? But also, why do you have to travel across state lines and go and play a contact sport with someplace in a state that we here in New York have, to my knowledge, is still have a quarantine on? I don't get it, and it doesn't seem, and it puts this fight between parents going up against each other and kids and everything else, and it's just a microcosm of the. Of the issue that we're seeing with the schools.
I want what I want, what I want, what I want. It too bad. You may want not to wear a mask. You may want to go back to work. You may want to go to a movie. You may want all of this stuff, but you shouldn't and you can't. And like that's what we should be saying right now.
Let's take a break.
But it's also sort of...
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Vera.
I wanted to just quickly note something. Thank you, Joe. I wanted to quickly note something about American individuality. I think, you know, I grew up in Germany, as many of the listeners know, and we are experiencing as younger children already that it's not just what you want or what your family wants, but it's also more based on communal decisions. I'm not saying that Germany is not individualistic, but in comparison to what I experienced here in the United States, so the sense of community and decision-making based more on a town, a region, or a state, and what's essential for every member of the community rather than just what's best for me is something that I find striking in terms of what we're experiencing right now.
Well, I'll let the question hang in the balance, but or just hang in the air as we go to a break, but, you know, how do we change that is our homework assignment. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many letters. We'll go to those, and we'll talk to Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Vera Karius-Kelly, and Linda Ellerby. We'll be right back. 47 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Let's get to a number of them before the top of the hour. Mark said, they told us their plan when they said the cure could not be worse than the disease. They valued profits over people, and as a result, will kill both. Tony says, what are the panelists' thoughts on a burn rate? New York City is still a very dense place, yet cases are low. Still, large numbers of people living in close proximity. I am sure they are not all wearing masks.
Well, I think it's clear a lot of people are wearing masks. You know, I think that it's extraordinary. The governor was quite severe in this, and in terms of his saying you got to wear a mask. I think people were listening to him, and I think that's why the rate is down.
We go to Louise, who says, please discuss the decision to not send data to the CDC, but to send the COVID data to a private company. Now we won't have any record, any accurate coordinated information or data about the increase or decrease in infections. That is the concern that you were mentioning before, Jen.
Yes. Yeah, it is absolutely my concern. And my kind of only hope right now of getting that data in real time is that, you know, I live in Massachusetts. We're on the other side of the state. There's MIT that the folks there come up with a way to create an open source public database where people can report data as they find it so that we can all see really what's going on. We've already seen disparities even within state systems. So it's really important that we have a good place to collect data and to protect, but also share that data.
But it is so totalitarian, so fascist to say, okay, in terms of my reelection, because after all, folks, that's what this is really all about. In terms of my reelection, I would rather not have this data out there. So let's not have it. Period. End of discussion. It couldn't be worse.
It's evil.
Yes. And do we understand? I mean, again, we talk about nobody really having a plan or a clue, but do we have an idea of how this is actually going to be operationalized?
I don't think we do, but that has been the problem all along, the lack of a plan or a clue. This administration has been entirely reactive. And if I can move on a little bit, look at the notion of schools.
Right.
They seem downright surprised that when summer ends, school starts every year. And it wasn't until people told Trump that the economy couldn't recover until schools reopened that he even put any focus on it. But getting our kids back to school safely should have been what the government was working on all summer. It should not come as a surprise that when summer ends, school starts every year.
He doesn't
care.
And
there is no possible excuse for the fact
that he doesn't care. He doesn't care.
Nothing has happened other than Betsy DeVos says, well, you know, let the public school system fail. Let these people go to religious schools.
And there's no money. There's no support. There's no reckoning any of the effects of that. Kids have lost family members during this. Teachers have been lost in a lot of ways. These schools, sure, they can technically go back, but they're going to go back limping and very prone.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't.
I think there's another fundamental issue with how schools are perceived under the Trump administration, namely directly related to the economy, and that schools are babysitting facilities rather than respecting teachers and all their contributions to the education and the future of our human resource in this country. It is shocking to me how teachers are not consulted. There's no funding for schools. Obviously, when you look at a lot of school buildings, they're not prepared to bring children back into this environment because the filter and filtering system and airflow is so outdated. It is often decades old, and I don't know.
Right, and that's the problem too, is that these issues have existed long before the pandemic started, because we have governments that are trying to piecemeal things together instead of coming up with good long-term solutions to boosting our schools, and this is going to make matters even worse when they try to reopen this fall.
Mm. Let's go to some more letters. You know,
demanding that schools reopen with no plan is just the same as demanding the virus be gone and reopening commerce with no plan. It is that old definition of insanity of doing the same thing over and over and keep hoping it will work the next time.
And I mean,
and so far, it's worked for him.
Even if he doesn't get his way, it works for him. Because in his mind, because he sees himself playing to that base. And he'll get credit for saying, well, he wanted the kids to go to school and now they can't go to school and it's everybody else's fault and it's certainly not his.
But isn't that base stand to be disrupted? Because once people see the reality, like let's just take Massachusetts, for example. Right now, schools are being asked to come up with three different case scenarios for reopening, one fully remote, one hybrid, one in person. But there's still no particular answer. So parents still can't make the decision on when to go back to work, and we can't get people to go back to work. You know, you're still stuck with the original problem.
Well, you're a brilliant education reporter, and we know it. And that's your beat at the Eagle.
However, I would take some issue with you that this has nothing to do with substantive educational outcomes. This has to do with politics and the politics of Donald Trump, which he has practiced all along.
Politics should not be in our schools in that way.
And you're right. But also, let us remember Donald Trump's famous dictum, "I love the undereducated." You say, when will people understand it? I'm saying they won't, not that group.
Well,
at the end of the day, schools, it doesn't matter where people come from. Public schools have to teach everyone. And, this is everyone's problem. You can't just say this people or that people, because that's not what school is all about.
Well, again, you're brilliant. I know that. And you're telling us what we know. Schools are important. We also know that human lives are important, and sending kids back to school or to camp or to any other place when they could be infected and bring it home doesn't leave us much choice, does it?
You know, it doesn't. But you also have to say, like, at the end of the day, especially when you're talking about private schools, it's a choice where people send their school. So it's a much more complex issue that boils down, you know. You could say it boils down to politics, but it doesn't. It's much more.
No, I don't get that. Can you explain a little bit more? I don't understand. It is political. We know that this president thinks in his own way that if he does this or that, it will help get him reelected. And there's a real disconnect between the reality that you have, so as always, I've said it before, brilliantly pointed out, why kids should go to school. We get that. On the other hand, kids should not die, and their parents shouldn't die. So when you put one up against the other, I think you have a pretty good guideline.
Yeah, and I mean, again, I think the issue is that the political approach to reopening schools is still not encompassing what schools really need. And that's the problem with this administration, whether you're talking about Trump or whether you're talking about DeVos and the other decision makers who are setting policies and examples for schools. And, you know, at the end of the day, families are going to go along with what, you know, their schools go along with. So you have to look at this at a lot of levels.
I think it's interesting to see how much choice parents will have too, especially for younger kids. As one of the scenarios is that you keep the older and the high school kids at home, you do that remotely, that opens up the buildings, allowing you to be able to social distance the younger students, and you have that kind of dynamic. But Jen, it seems like, I mean, and the big problem that I keep reading about, including in your work, is that this is all fine until, like, the reopening of a restaurant. It's fine until 3 or 4 staff members come down with the virus, or teachers come down with the virus, and then you're right back to square one again.
And not only that, Joe, I've got 2 6-year-old grandsons and a 3-year-old granddaughter. And I have to tell you, if you watch them and the roughhousing and the other stuff, you can tell them, don't touch another kid. Don't go anywhere near another kid. Forget it, Jack. It ain't going to happen. So when you keep the older ones home and you send the little ones to school, think about what the outcome of that's going to be.
Yeah, and it's going to be a heavy weight on all fronts. It's going to be hard on families. It's going to be hard on schools. And it's going to be hard on businesses because, you know, I think gone are the ideas of snow days, but you're going to have COVID days where, you know, if a classroom gets infected, then there's going to be a portion of the population. And then how are you getting a fair and equitable education if not everyone can be present? And, you know, this is prone. You have students who are prone. You have teachers and staff who are prone. And then you have families, because we know, you know, this disease can spread very easily within, you know, close-knit units. So these are all things that have to be taken under consideration. And, you know, the struggle with families is, like, how do you make the best choice, right? Do you trust that your provider, whether it's daycare or your school, will keep your children's health in mind? And, you know, we can't even stop the common flu, which delivers big hits to school every year. So you know, I'm hesitant of how you think you can really control this this virus in schools.
Let's take a break when we come
and
back.
And also, I mean, you know, Jen is right. I just wanted to say for a second, the question of choice, who actually has the choice among the parents to decide whether to send kids or not? And is it only those who are perhaps middle class, with positions, with jobs right now? Or what happens with all the people that are forecasted to lose their apartments, their houses, and experience a crash in their economic standing in this country in the coming months?
Well, we can fix that. We can fix that. We can give them the money to pay the rent. We can give them, but you can't make them undead.
But is it going to happen in a timely fashion, too?
Yeah, well, we're about to see. We're about to see whether Mitch McConnell can run from this or whether he'll pass the HEROES Act.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Carias Kelly, Jen Smith, and Lynn Ellerby. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to this Thursday edition of the Roundtable. July 16th at 7 minutes past 10 o'clock, we have Alan Chartok, Vera Carias Kelly, Jen Smith, and Linda Ellerby with us, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Yes, Alan.
Joe, if I may, I hope we're all listening to the news and not getting something to eat during the breaks. However, Ray Graff just read a news story that I found incredible, which is, United States and Britain and some others are very angry that the Russians have been trying to get a hold of our information on COVID relief. In other words, vaccines and such, and that they're there. This is what we should be spending our time on right now, saying, oh, no, American capitalism comes first. We can't have you stealing our intellectual secrets. I find that extraordinary.
Yeah, the UK and US, as well as Canada, are accusing Russia of hacking virus vaccine trials.
Extraordinary.
And yet, just this morning, I went on Facebook to a timeline of someone I know right here in Great Barrington, who is a big Trump supporter. And one of the memes, I look at his timeline regularly, one of the memes he posted said, why do we need to spend money on a vaccine to prevent something that you can prevent just by washing your hands?
Well, there you go. And this is why we should be having briefings and having scientists and doctors tell us how to behave. We have a lot of letters. Let's get to as many as we can here before we move on to another subject. Mary Lou writes and says, whenever Trump creates chaos, this time the back-to-school mess, I ask myself, what does he want us to ignore? I do believe he is diverting us from Russia's paying bounties to the Taliban for killing our soldiers. Trump has yet to address this or call Russia out for it. We absolutely must keep this on our radar and hold Trump and Russia accountable for this. Steve says, over the years, including today, panel members have frequently misquoted Trump. I'll never forget the exact words I heard him use at his rally. I love the poorly educated. He did not use the word undereducated. Really?
I'm so glad you wrote that letter. It means a great deal to me. Come on.
The difference may be subtle, but not insignificant, especially given the choice of Betsy DeVos as education secretary, says the letter writer Steve. We go to Paul, who says, Alan nailed it. The killing of the data monitoring of COVID-19 by the CDC is a fascist and totalitarian action by the Trump dictatorship. Where is the Democratic Party outrage? Where are the lawsuits? Where is the thundering rejection of this action by the people? The people of the United States are allowing the fascism, just like the German people did in the 1930s. Brian says, kids shouldn't die, their parents shouldn't die, and teachers, all caps on that one, shouldn't die. Where is the plan and budget to provide full PPE to protect all the 50-plus-year-old teachers from dozens of little potential virus carriers? Jack says this is no different from him hiding all of his business dealings. It is his method of doing what he does best, lying. Eric says, should Trump be impeached over his failure to protect Americans from coronavirus? He is lying and incompetent and killing Americans. Should the House send out this message that they are considering it? Or can we begin a class action lawsuit on behalf of the American people to have Trump removed? Alan, you want to
the second response is unfortunately under the Constitution, you can't. No class action. I get the anger from the letter, but you can't. Secondly, it is an interesting question. I've asked it for many politicians themselves. Should he be impeached a second time and just make it clear that he is just doing these degenerate things? I think one of the reasons to do that is that you put pressure, because the United States Senate is flippable right now. You put pressure on those senators who have constantly voted against any kind of sanction on Trump, not helped, by the way, that Tommy Tuberville, or whatever his name is, down in Alabama, won by 20% over Sessions. You know, those guys are between the proverbial rock and a hard place. We know it. But this would put more pressure on them if you did impeach him a second time.
We go to Denise, who says, I've never written to the roundtable before, but as a parent, grandparent, and teacher, I'm livid about the situation in this country. I will not rant. What is the environment of the school that is the proposed model for the return of the children? The definition of public school before the lockdown can't possibly be what people seem to expect. I know for a fact that this is not being addressed. Why? Do we just send our children to tread water in shark-infested, uncharted waters? Question mark. Jen, you want that one?
I mean, these are definitely valid questions and concerns. The thing is, people don't have the answer, and it's hard to put up that answer because every single classroom, the makeup of every single classroom is different. And this is one of the things I see teachers advocating for, is that we have to take care of the education and well-being of all children, whether they speak English or they don't, whether they have special needs or they don't, whether they come from affluent communities or they don't, whether they have access to technology or they don't. And this is the complexities of reopening schools.
May I suggest that we're probably going to see about as much success as we've seen on, and you're quite right. I mean, we have to take care of the health of the students and the education. Well, that hasn't worked out so well when it came to we have to take care of the economy and the health of the workers. Look what has happened. There are no surprises here. What they told us would happen, what science told us would happen, has happened. When we saw the late April and early May openings in Arizona, Texas, and Florida, places like this where they took care of the economy, people are dying. The virus is killing people. Some things are simply mutually exclusive, and choices have to be made in this area. And I think right now, unless we get this virus under control, none of the other stuff gets under control.
That's a good point.
And to throw yet another bomb into the mix, sooner or later, we're going to have a vaccine. And this gets directly to Jen's expertise as the education writer for the and editor for the Eagle. There will be people, and believe me, there are a lot of people who are ticked off at me already about this, who will say, I'm not going to inject anything into my child. And you know that that is going to raise holy hell. When that happens, because the anti-vaxxers will of course say that, and people will get sick as a result of it. It's that simple.
Well, it's not just the anti-vaxxers. I mean, they are a group, and they have been a group. But now, to go back to what I said earlier, now it's become a political thing as well. So it won't just be the anti-vaxxers saying, oh, you're not going to put that in my kid. It will be many of the people who politically want to believe Donald Trump, that this is a Democratic hoax or a fake media plot or just nothing at all. Big.
Except
well, and I think it goes beyond that, though, in this case. with the development of this vaccine, it's scary because it's a competitive process. There's a lot of incentive out there, and we don't know. Vaccines, we know for a fact, vaccines take years to develop. So to see such a critical vaccine being developed quite hastily, even though we have more information than ever to develop vaccines, and now we have more people than ever working on this particular vaccine. Another thing about vaccine, we know they're not 100%. So no matter how much vaccine you have out there, if we can get enough vaccine out there, you know, remember we're populations of millions. That's another thing. Can we produce a vaccine at that volume, that quick enough to provide to everyone? And that rollout will take years. And then you're looking at cost and who has access to this vaccine. And that is not going to happen equitably either. We know that. So these are the problems with, you know, even though we're saying we have to wait to get a vaccine, it's not going to solve 100% of the problems or the fears or create the solution that is needed. So there are other actions that need to be done.
Well, let me ask you this.
So let me go back to the very original point that Joe made. Namely, he quoted an immunologist who said, "We are on a journey without a roadmap." And that is exactly, we're spinning in the mud. We're spinning in the mud because we don't trust the data. We don't have federal leadership. We don't have a unified voice and direction. We don't have a roadmap that affects public health, education, the economy, and this is what we're facing. We need somebody to tell us honestly in this country that this we might be facing this not just this fall. We seem to be talking about January, miraculously it will change. Who has told us, in fact, that it might not be lasting for another year? So we have a reality in front of us where we have to be much more realistic and serious about scientific data, public health, and processing what that means for every single sector in our lives.
Vera, that's all true. Nevertheless, we're about to have a vaccine, and I know what I would do if the scientific authorities said, you know, this is a safe vaccine. I would vaccinate rather than face death for my kid.
But that's a great question. Would you? But and I think this gets to Jen's point too. But as would I under what you just said, I would too. But do you trust the people? Like, who are you going to trust to say that it's a safe vaccine?
Donald Trump or the scientists? Now, the interesting thing here is Trump himself thinks that this vaccine is going to save his behind. And has been saying that. So in other words, his issue is he can't afford to come out against the vaccine because it's the only thing under the sun that he thinks, I don't believe it, but that he thinks will save him.
But I think Jen's point again is correct that you to do this properly, it can take years to
how many people have died? 137,420 people in the United States. 137,000.
Right, and also, but like, how many people are also facing, you know, exorbitant medical bills because of this? So if it's a public health crisis, are we going to create a public health vaccine that is accessible, i.e. free, for every single person who qualifies? Well, we couldn't even provide testing. We can't even provide testing for everyone who should be tested and then to trace that. So how are we going to effectively provide a vaccine for everyone who needs it, which is everyone is what we're saying.
Well, you certainly got to try, Jen. 137,000 people have died in the United States. That's a lot. You're so right.
I don't think anyone's not going to try, but can we actually deliver?
Well, but you're correct.
Are they going to charge people? Do you know how much like an AIDS vaccine cost or even cancer treatment? So, you know, are we going to jack up those prices for such? They're all deadly diseases, but we don't treat them and make the necessary medical treatments
fair and
accessible for everyone.
Well, that's all true. And the hint we got at the beginning when I talked about the Russians, you know, being called out by the United States for violating corporate interests in vaccine ownership gives us a pretty good idea of where this may go. But, you know, there are some imperfect choices here, Jen. some imperfect choices between you got a vaccine, you're being told, and you can either trust it or not, that your kids won't die as a result of that. It isn't as if the what ifs that you're raising aren't all valid. They are. Nevertheless, what do you want to do? Not do it?
Well, I just don't want to get into something where you have a hydrochloroquine or a, you know, or God forbid, bleach, which have also been touted by the administration that you're pushing forward. I mean, it gets into trust of who is telling you what. And as Jen said, and this has been something I've been concerned about for a long time, is that it's a competition. It's a rush. And we're rushing to a vaccine as opposed to knowing what it does. I mean, we know what even a bad flu shot can do to us.
And we knew what happened with the polio vaccine.
Right.
There were big issues. Nevertheless,
thalidomide, any of those things.
Sure.
All right, let's go to some other letters. Ruth says, although I agree with Alan that Trump deserves a second impeachment for the disaster he's made of the coronavirus response, people have died directly because of his actions and inaction. But I don't agree with starting another trial at this time. In fact, I think that Trump would love to campaign against an impeachment. Let's keep the focus on the terrible job he's done in office, exactly what he and his campaign doesn't want to discuss. I don't think I heard you call for a second impeachment, Alan.
Actually, I did. Okay. I did understand why you might want one. I mean, it is something that could be out there. Look, I think the letter writer is very fair in what he or she is saying. And you know, there are real reasons not to do it. Do I think that the Democratic House of Representatives is going to follow her logic rather than others? Yes, I do. I don't think there'll be a second impeachment.
Martina says, my niece and her husband who live in Maryland have hired a private tutor for their children. This is to supplement their online classes. I know many are not able to afford a tutor, and it is a sacrifice for my niece, but they are very afraid to send their children into the classroom, and they live in a state that is holding steady with COVID. Robert says, Vera has it correct. Trump is a confirmed sociopath who cannot operate under real world or life crisis outside of corporate killer mode solutions to get what he wants. The senators have given our country over to a dictator, which is what they wanted. Jim says Trump is...
I want to argue that a little bit. I don't think that those senators, those Republican senators, are going home to their husbands or to their wives, see what I did there, and not saying this guy's an idiot and he's crazy and he's this and that. We know they're saying that. We've heard that on the congressional corner from people who talk to those Republicans. We know that. They are doing what is politically best for them, and we have names for that kind of thing.
Anybody else? Okay. Jim says Trump is doing what he is doing because he is completely over his head now. He doesn't have a clue. He can't fake it, so he continues to huff and puff and tries his best to hide his stupidity.
He can't fake it, but will he try to steal it?
Marty says, please consider the possibility that Trump is handling the pandemic the way he is because he is incapable of doing otherwise. If you are literally unable to see any flaws in your behavior, there is nothing to change, and suggestions otherwise are attacks. In sum, he's a psychopath. Earl says, so you can decide that your health and that of the folks around you is nobody's business in Georgia. Go out to dinner and smoke them if you got them. Where is the line? And Kate writes about mask orders and says, do you think Trump, through mysterious back channels, ordered or prompted the governor of Georgia elsewhere, too, to countermand the governor's mask order? It is this part of the pyramid power structure that Trump seems to favor, where everything has to be determined by him and him alone? No insurgencies allowed. Also, is this sort of thing going to push citizens to take things into their own hands, and underground will people begin to govern themselves?
A very interesting question, because here we are in a place where we have deep suspicions towards who is behind what decision-making process and if it is in our best interest. And this is what leads to this bifurcation in the country, the constant mistrust in data. And what I was mentioning earlier is what I fear will be a long-lasting damage that is happening right now in this country in terms of not being able to really look at data, understand where information comes from, what the sources are, and basically it will negatively affect the future of this country and its ability to compete nationally and internationally. I think this is tremendously painful for the future, hurtful for the future of the United States.
Anybody else? All right, let's go ahead. No? All right.
I just want to add, and I agree. I mean, these long-term effects are going to be devastating, and we don't even know what they are. But even before we get to that, we don't even know how this coronavirus story ends, and it's not over. And this doesn't even make me happy, but I happen to believe to be one of the people who believes that we ain't seen nothing yet. And whatever we think we weren't prepared for is nothing compared to what we aren't yet prepared for. Politics has not worked, and we have not yet returned to science to be our guide. Letting politics run it has not worked.
You look at what hasn't worked, and you're absolutely right. And so where are we now? Yesterday, the U.S. reported its second highest single-day total of new cases. Leaders are scrambling to order masks and limit gatherings. There is a shortage in many areas of the country of PPE. There are hospitals that are out of room and are stretched thin and do not have enough people working in them. These are headlines that we had in April. These are headlines that we had for several weeks in the spring. And yet, here we are once again dealing with this in different parts of the country. The difference between then and now is then we were in more or less a national lockdown, and now we continue to try to reopen and test the waters, which just seems to be counterintuitive as the numbers go up and up and up.
Well, there is an old saying that in war you do not prepare for what you think the enemy might do or is going to do. You prepare for what you think the enemy can do. Donald Trump and his administration from day one have been willing to prepare only for what they think the enemy might do. That's where we are now, and that's what we're facing. And if we don't start, and the enemy is COVID, if we don't start preparing for what it can do instead of what is the least bit you think it might do, I see years of this, not months, not a month, not will it last for Christmas. The consequences could be incredibly devastating around the world. You talk about economic problems now. The economies could simply disappear, and the deaths could be in the millions. And no one seems... No, that's not true. Many people do. But no one in the administration wants to address what the enemy can do in the fight with corona.
Vera, I know you want to talk, and I'm going to just put you on hold for a second because I have to take a break. When we come back, we'll have time to... I'll come to you right away. I want to talk about this. And also just this idea. I mean, we look at Washington State, which is a state that was initial center of the U.S. outbreak. They had a lockdown. They contained it. And now a new wave is showing just how complicated things can get. We'll talk about all of that. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this news break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our final go-round this morning with our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Linda Ellerby, and Vera Akarius-Kelly. Vera, I promised you a first talk on this segment back. Go ahead.
Yes, what I wanted to say is in response to what Alan was talking about in terms of, you know, focusing so much on the United States, really, COVID is a global pandemic. We have scientists, amazing scientists all over the world. I mean, when you look at our excessive focus on what's happening on the United States, we don't know that this immunization or some future medical treatments will come out of the United States. They can come from a European country, an Asian country. There are lots of people that collaborate and do scientific research. They share data. I mean, there is a global collaboration level on scientific data beyond anything we've ever seen, with the exception of the United States. So what we have is a myopic focus right now on the United States inside of this country, and we are incapable of apparently at looking at what other solutions are beginning to emerge, to at least in part, before we have an actual treatment for this disease, how other countries are managing bits and pieces of their economy, bits and pieces of their public health strategies, and why we cannot look beyond our borders and figure out this may work for us, or this piece we can try and modify for the context of the United States is beyond me. This is part of the Trump disease we have in this country. We are so special here. We're so unique in the United States. We're the only ones who can come up with answers. Well, this is a fallacy, and we need to really begin to think more broadly, more internationally, more globally to figure out how to respond.
So, I mean, we have started this. We can extrapolate this into many different camps, though, can't we, Alan? As far as that we don't we want out of anything that is international. We're not playing well with others on anything.
Well, it's true Trumpism, obviously, that make America great again, chest beating, and doing all of that. And I think Vera has a fair point that we should always be looking for cooperation, whether it's on the environment or whether it's on treating COVID or our approaches to how we have done it. So I think it's a fair comment.
All right. Anyone else on that? Okay. Let's go to the very sexy story about Twitter attacks. Brazen online attack targets VIP Twitter users in a Bitcoin scam. It was about 4 in the afternoon on Wednesday on the East Coast when chaos struck online. Dozens of the biggest names in America, including Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Kanye West, Bill Gates, and Elon Musk, posted similar messages on Twitter. Send Bitcoin and the famous people would send back double your money. It was all a scam, of course, the result of one of the most brazen online attacks in memory. A first wave of attacks hit the Twitter accounts of prominent cryptocurrency leaders and companies, but soon after, the list of victims broadened to include a who's who of Americans in politics, entertainment, and tech, and a major show forced by the hackers. Twitter quickly removed many of the messages, but in some cases, similar tweets were sent again for the same account, suggesting that Twitter was powerless to regain control. The company eventually disabled broad swaths of its service, including the ability of verified users to tweet, for a couple of hours as it scrambled to prevent the scam from spreading further. The company sent a tweet saying that it was investigating the problem and looking for a fix. You may be unable to tweet or reset your password while we review and address this incident, the company said in a second tweet. Service was restored around 8:30 Wednesday night. So now they go on to investigate this breach, and what the initial investigation has shown is that several employees who had access to internal systems had their accounts compromised in a coordinated social engineering attack, according to a spokesman. Referring to attacks that trick people into giving up their credentials, the attackers then used Twitter's internal systems to tweet from high-profile accounts like that of Mr. Biden. Concerning, certainly, and confusing, but you wonder with the instruments and the technology that we are told that many of these companies have or still can fall prey to this kind of attack.
Can I just jump in and say that I don't know why people find this surprising. I can't find a way to keep spam calls from coming to my house, and neither can my phone company or anything else. Why should this be surprising? You stop the spam that comes to you?
No.
Can you stop the things that come to you if you're on Facebook every day that are phishing for your information? My heart goes out to Twitter. No, not really. My heart goes out to Bill Gates. No, not really. There are bigger things to worry about in the world right now other than this.
Well, but at the same time, I think it's not surprising because these kind of scams happen all the time, but it is alarming. It's alarming because if, you know, I'm going to get a little techie here, but, you know, the fact that this was a coordinated attack, it seems like something is testing the waters, you know, especially using influential accounts, influencing the exchange of money. The fact that it wasn't just a blanket spam, if you actually look at the language of the tweets that went out, they're all different. So that this indicates quite a bit of skill. And again, whenever I see breaches on, you know, security at this level, I think what's going to happen to the big security things like our social security data or our election data or things like that. So what does an incident like this implicate for the larger cyber world and in the world of cybersecurity?
Mm. Anybody else? Vera?
Well, I mean, I agree with Jen. I think she has a really important point to make. We need to focus on much more cybersecurity and also sort of convincing the general public that just because you participate in social media platforms and disclose information, that does not mean this information will stay controlled or that it will not be sold around the world. So it seems that people have sort of lost the control over the notion that private information might want to keep private. I mean, this is sort of the sense that you just expose everything and then you hope that it'll be understood and used in only positive ways. I mean, I just don't really understand why we don't focus more on cybersecurity education for the general public, really, and then invest profoundly into securing our electoral system and, you know, doing something about massive hacking approaches that are clearly being sponsored in Russia, in Iran, in North Korea, and they're pumping some serious money into those campaigns.
Jen?
And I just want to say that, you know, this particular hacking scam is interesting, right? Like, so the hackers kind of hacked, and they're saying, look, we can hack big name accounts. I also find it extremely humorous that most of the accounts hacked were predominantly male, except for companies like Apple, which also got hacked, which is funny because they're known for having everything proprietary. But the only female account that was hacked that I can find was Kim Kardashian's. I just think that's really amusing. but Kanye got it too, so there's equity there. You know, that the scam, this kind of scam is just normally designed to make money. And it did make money. It's still making money for people who are still seeing this out there. Not a lot, like, compared to other scams. So it's over $100,000, or the equivalent was like 12 Bitcoin. I still don't understand that currency exchange, so I'm not going to try. But so it's, on one hand, this hack is a little bit of a taunt because they weren't phishing for any particular information. But it is, again, I will say, it does indicate that it's a test of something larger. And I think that's what the public should be concerned about, and that this is not your typical spam.
Yeah.
The fact that
I just
want to say one thing real quickly, and that is the Russians are very adept at doing this stuff. We know that. And I'm not going to go into the Bitcoin because like Jen, I don't understand it. But the Russians are good at it. Who are friends of the Russians? Oh, let's see now. Donald Trump, friend of the Russians? Does he ever say anything critical of the Russians? No, he doesn't. So
Just let's keep that in mind, that when it comes to hacking and it comes to the Russians doing what we already know from the very beginning of this program through this segment today, we know that they're instrumental in that. And we know that Trump shuts up, and then let's try to figure out what's really going on.
Also, I wanted to point out that the United States does it as well, as a cyber war, as part of its cyber warfare program. So we should
absolutely
not
every country hacked.
The United States is deeply involved. A lot of countries do this. So the damaging of other countries' economy or messing up their nuclear power plants, the United States is deeply involved in those kinds of processes as well.
I would like to, we just have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I just want to talk a little bit. We haven't talked a lot about the political conventions because we don't know a lot. We know that the Democratic convention will most likely be online, and the GOP convention moved from North Carolina to Florida. Now, according to the RNC chairwoman, Ronna McDaniel, that they are scaling it back quite a bit, actually. For admittance to the convention, it will include outdoor and indoor venues. The first 3 days of the convention will allow for about 2,500 people, and then when the president attends for the final day, delegates will get a guest, and alternate delegates can also attend. It's about 6,000 to 7,000 people. In the letter, McDaniel says the changes are to comply with Florida rules after the party moved most of the convention from North Carolina. When we made the changes, we had hoped to be able to plan a traditional convention celebration in which we're all accustomed. However, adjustments must be made to comply with state and local health guidelines, which, of course, is why they moved out of North Carolina in the first place.
Florida, of all places, Florida, the scene, the home, the current home of the pandemic. And this guy, once again, is going to try everything in his power to have a prominent role for himself, despite what's good for people. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and there's, in fact, the line in this article says, cases have surged in Florida in recent weeks, and some local officials are considering additional shutdowns to try to stem the spread of the virus. But McDaniel and Trump have been determined to hold an in-person convention, and some of the president's advisors see it as a crucial part of gaining momentum in the polls as he trails Joe Biden.
A Hail Mary pass, if there ever was one.
Yeah, well, I so agree with you, and this is just ridiculous, because in essence, this is a message that basically says, stay tuned. We might have to make further adjustments because, really, in essence, I don't think Jacksonville is going to be the place where this convention might be held at all.
It seems, I think you're right, Vera. I think it's a lot can change between now and a month from now. All right, we are done. My thanks to everybody for being a part. Alan, thank you so much, as always.
Well, great to be here.
Vera, thank you. Jen Smith, Linda, always a pleasure. We will be back and continue our program right after this.